Okay, this is continuing with Harry Minnett on 6 March 78 at Radio Physics. We're more or less repeating the last half hour that was lost on 3rd March. So let's start with the whole Parkes dish story. And you were in England, I know, for 4 years working on it. But can you tell me about... Bowen had already been thinking about it even before then,
Yes, that's right. He'd been working at the problem of getting sufficient money to build one, first of all, and also thinking about how to go about it, how to achieve it if he had the money. And he'd had discussions with high-level people in England and America, getting advice on those questions, which was his usual technique, go to well-known eminent people and get their best advice. And as far as the design was concerned, he'd taken advice in England from whom I'm not sure, but probably on the files. And out of this had come a decision to pick it a firm of consulting engineers known as Freeman Fox and Partners, who were different from the people who designed the Jodrell Bank dish, which upset them a bit at the time for a little while.
This was before the real Jodrell troubles began.
Yes. I suppose that it was financial problems that came about, and also the fact that the technical specification had been written before the hydrogen line had been discovered.
That's right.
So that while they were in the middle, I think, of perhaps early construction, they realised this and I suppose tried to do what they could, but doing anything like that at that stage is a costly exercise.
Yeah.
So it was many years later before they really recovered from it, I think. But the prices did run away, and there were parliamentary inquiries. Now, some of that must perhaps been in the wind. Taffy would have talked to Lovell, he knew extremely well from the wartime. Perhaps had some of his worries expounded.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it got advice, and the upshot was he picked this firm of consulting engineers, Freeman Fox and Partners, and he'd also got Barnes Wallace of Vickers Armstrong Aircraft as a consultant, and he had a number of ideas. So all of these things had been on the go before I was aware even of them. Before 1955 sometime, I'd been in radio navigation up to 51 onwards till early 55, I guess, and then I went into a radio astronomy problem that Jerry Pulizzi put up.
That's right, you've already told about that. Yeah.
And then I went on to straight onto the Parkes dish out of that, because the money did become available from the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation. And then the Australian government gave the other half of an equal amount of money, and that was judged to be enough, £400,000, $800,000 in our dollars. So that... Well, when the money became available, there was a small group formed to consider what the specification should be for the designers. This consisted of Christensen and Mills and myself, Pawsey and Bowen, and there would have been a couple of others, Frank Kerr, and possibly a couple of others I can't recall. And we had to consider just what it is we could write down for the designers, and it turned out to be a fairly broad spec in the end, and deliberately so that we could operate flexibly with the designers as the study went along.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted something over a couple of hundred feet, if the money would run to that, to be in the same sort of class as the Jodrell Bank telescope, and to operate down to 21 centimetres. Those were important requirements. We thought about wind specifications or any other trade-off that could be made that would give us more for our money. For example, we decided we needn't operate above a certain wind speed, 30 miles an hour.
You didn't have a sight yet, though?
No sight, no. It was just a general observation that the stars would be there the next night and we could go back.
Right. It wasn't like a military radar.
That's right. And we thought a great deal about the geometric arrangement of the dish. Were the ways of making a dish entirely novel ways that might be better once you got down to fundamentals? And I remember at the back of this book there were a number of artists' impressions of all mm-hmm. sorts of peculiar structures, great spheres floating on water and so on. Most of them had the difficulty of control in them. They were okay for supporting something, perhaps. But when you thought later on about the control problem, it was pretty horrendous. Nevertheless, people did think pretty fundamentally. We thought about the surface requirements at 21 centimetre, worked out the leakage through mesh, just how porous it could be to let the wind whistle through and keep the cost down on the structure, and things of that sort. The sort of radio frequency requirements of the dish, what the focal ratio ought to be, what could be fed properly or reasonably with the feeds at that time, whether how much the support for the feed could be allowed to block the dish, and so forth and so on.
What were the final specs in terms of shortest wavelength of operation?
Well, we left it at 21. It had to work at least down to 21. It wasn't that until after the design study had been going for a while that I realised over there that we could go lower. But we didn't change. We just designed it to go lower, and that got built into whatever the manufacturers made finally.
Well, that's really incredible that just now it's operating at 3 millimetres.
Yes.
With modification, of course,
yes.
But it was a factor of 60 better than the specs for the thing.
Well, yes, I think we're lucky. John Ruse's theory of tolerances on surface wasn't available to us at the time, and that comes out in terms of an RMS error.
Right.
We tended to just talk about an error. And
why do you say you're lucky?
Well, I think if you do it that way, it's the RMS that counts, and we kept that peak error well down. If it had been out, we might have put an RMS at the same value.
Just, you mean inherently in the design?
Inherently in the design, I think it was overdone.
I see.
In retrospect, but